Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. J.R.R. Tolkien had hobbits and dwarves and elves and men joining up to fight evil. George R.R. Martin has men and women in chainmail and fur and chaos, pretty much lining up to fight each other. You can call his mega-selling series A Song of Ice and Fire a medieval fantasy, but its tensions and politics and sex and human complication feel quite real. He's out with his long-awaited latest installment, and with me in the studio this hour on Point, a conversation with George R.R. Martin. You can join the conversation. Is this your tailspinner? Have you roamed in the Seven Kingdoms, the land beyond the wall? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. His world has been all over HBO this spring. Here's just a little bit of back and forth from the medieval fantasy world of George R.R. Martin from HBO's Game of Thrones.
Carl Vejvin. May I present my honored guests, Viserys of House Targaryen, the third of his name, the rightful king of the Andals and the First Men, and his sister, Daenerys of House Targaryen. Aji Anaha Ashalat.
Do you see your name, Viserys? When Dothraki are defeated in combat, they cut off their braid so the whole world can see their shame. Khal Drogo has never be defeated. He's a savage, of course, but he's one of the finest killers alive. And you will be his queen.
And you will be his queen, and there we are in the land of George R.R. Martin. He's been called the new fantasy king and the American Tolkien. His projected 7-part series has sold 15 million volumes worldwide. The first book has been made into the HBO drama there, Game of Thrones. He is co-executive producer. His new book, A Dance with Dragons, is out today. He's with me in the studio. George R.R. Martin, it's great to have you right here.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
And you survived. Your fans were absolutely howling. We've all read about this, of course. They were ready to come for you, laying siege to you there in Santa Fe.
Yes, I've always been afraid of a mob showing up my door with torches and pitchforks. But, I finally got the book out, so hopefully that will please them for a few days anyway, till they've read it, and then they'll be starting for the new ones.
So. Calm the beast, at least for a moment, 1,016 pages or something like that. It will keep them busy for a little while.
I hope so.
Can you tell us where this installment lies in the arc or arcs of your now 5-part series headed for 7? What's going on this time?
Well, it's a little unusual. 5 years ago when the 4th book of Feast for Crows came out, that book, when I was writing it, was getting extremely long. So I decided that I had to split that into 2 books. But instead of doing a chronological split, just breaking it in the middle, I did a geographic split and divided it by character.
Mm-hmm.
So A Feast for Crows, which came out in 2005, focused on one set of characters, mostly around the capital city of King's Landing. And I left out some other characters, so including some very important popular characters like Daenerys Targaryen, Tyrion Lannister, Jon Snow.
All of these back this time.
All of them back. This is the flip side, if you will, of A Feast for Crows. This is the other book that takes place not after A Feast for Crows, but simultaneously with it, but in different places and starring different characters. So it picks up the story and carries it forward and tells the story, their story, and then the two streams rejoin in the second half of Dance with Dragons.
You started out in the realm of years ago now, in the realm of comic books, and then very much in science fiction. What brought you over into this realm of kings and queens and furs and daggers and chainmail and, horses in battle dress? What pulled you in here?
Well, it was really not a change. I mean, when I was a kid growing up in Bayonne, New Jersey, where I was born and raised, mm-hmm. I read a lot of comic books. I read science fiction, Robert A. Heinlein and Isaac Asimov, mm-hmm. Eric Frank Russell, Andre Norton. But I also read horror stories by H.P. Lovecraft, was one of my favorites. And I read fantasy by Robert E. Howard, the creative Conan, Fritz Leiber, Fafhrd mm-hmm. and the Grey Master, and of course, J.R. Tolkien, who I read, I think, when I was 13. And
but still, with all that reading, yes, we can see it. We'll talk about it. But with all that, you could have ended up in outer space or some futuristic dystopia or you name it.
I did. To tell the truth, I never really saw distinctions between these genres. They all seemed to me to be flavors, if you will, of imaginative fiction. Of romantic fiction, the great romantic tradition as opposed to the realistic tradition mm-hmm. in literature. My father called it all weird stuff. He said, I liked weird stuff. He liked Westerns, so his taste was more grounded, at least in his view. But I was always, fighting a dragon or going off to the stars or something like that. So when I began to write, I wrote all of this stuff. I wrote superhero stories because of the comics, and I wrote science fiction, and I wrote fantasy right from the beginning. My first published story was a science fiction story, but my second published story was a fantasy story.
So what's the unique flavor then? If some of the basic elements in here are common across all settings, what does it mean to a writer like you to work at such length now in this realm that's organic? It has castles and queens and, old-fashioned stuff, furs and wolves. And
There's something about the castles and the knights and the Age of Chivalry that's always appealed to me, particularly about knighthood. I mean, I've always thought that was an interesting issue to explore, and I talk a lot about it in these books. If you look at human history, the code of chivalry, as was promulgated in the Middle Ages, is mm-hmm. one of the most idealistic codes ever put forward for a warrior. The whole idea of using your might to defend the weak, protect the innocent, you were more, supposedly, in theory, you were more than just a soldier. You were a champion. But that was the theory. In practice, mm-hmm. of course, mm-hmm. knights were bloodthirsty killers, and they were the great warriors of their age. And in that contradiction between the ideals and the reality, I think there's immense drama, and that's one of the things that draws me to it. That being said, I think all this stuff that I write about, aliens and spaceships in the science fiction stories and castles and dragons and whatever in the fantasy stories – is all in the nature of furniture. My guiding principle has always been what Faulkner said in his Nobel Prize speech, where he said that the only thing worth writing about is the human heart in conflict with itself. And I think that's true. The rest is just the trappings. You can have an alien in your story, and it can be set on a distant planet 10,000 years in the future, or you can set it in Middle Earth or my Westeros or any imaginary land you want, or it can be about vampires and werewolves if you're writing horror. But it's still ultimately, if it's going to be a good story worth reading about, it's about the human heart in conflict with itself. It's about people and our emotions and the decisions we make.
How did you end up with the same initials as J.R.R. Tolkien? It seems so unlikely. Did Mama and Papa Martin set out to read a little fantasy writer here?
It was purely coincidence. I was born with one of them. The first R I was given at birth, Raymond, which was my father's name. Mm-hmm. And I was Catholic when I was born. So at age 13, I took a confirmation name. And
Richard.
I took the name of my favorite cousin, who was a couple years older than me and, was sort of the guy I looked up with. He was really cool. I wanted to be like him. So
did you have some notion, I recall, in about that age, fantasizing about different names I might take? Did you know J.R.R., that is Ronald Reuel Tolkien, was out there? Was it appealing to you to have R.R. as a double middle initial?
Yeah, I think it might have been. I don't know if it was because of Tolkien. I just liked the double thing was kind of cool. Also, George Martin is, as I found out at various points in my later life, is a tremendously common name. And without the RR, it's instantly forgettable. There are other George Martins. Of course, there's Sir George Martin, who was the manager of the Beatles.
But most kids don't pick up on
George Martin,
this one.
Who was a defensive end of the New York Giants.
But at 13 and confirmation time, you were picking up on this, preparing your marketing strategy?
Probably not. But when I did begin to write my first stories, I wanted my name to be distinctive. I wanted it to be something that people would remember. So I was using the RR in my byline in as early as high school when I was writing for comic fanzines, little amateur magazines that I was publishing little amateur superhero stories in.
The New Yorker says compared to most epic fantasy fiction, certainly compared to J.R.R. Tolkien, yours feels, has relatively little magic and feels dangerous, lusty, and real.
Well, I'll take that as a compliment. Yes, it's definitely low magic compared to most fantasy. I think fantasy requires magic. It's one of the things that makes it fantasy. But I think magic has to be handled very carefully. And actually, I think if you look at Tolkien, which I did because he is the master and he's a writer who I vastly admire, who's had great influence on my own work. But if you look at what Tolkien did, his Middle-earth and his book, there's a great sense of magic that suffuses it, but there's very little onstage magic. I mean, yes. Gandalf is identified as a wizard, but he never does spells. He never bends over a cauldron mixing up a brew.
His staff gets pretty fiery once in a while, but not too often.
It glows a little, yeah, but when orcs attack, he fights with a sword.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour with medieval fantasy writer George R. R. Martin, the writer behind HBO's Game of Thrones and the huge-selling author of the epic series A Song of Ice and Fire. His devoted readers, 15 million copies in this series sold so far, have waited, about 6 years for his latest book. It's called A Dance with Dragons. It is out today, and he's out of his redoubt in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and with me here in the studio. Of course, HBO picked it up in Game of Thrones and gave it a very wide cable television audience. Here's a little bit that the Night's Watch is a group of men who guard the northern border of George R. R. Martin's Seven Kingdoms. Lord Mormont, commander of the Night's Watch, tells here a new crop of watchmen where their loyalties should lie.
A man of the Night's Watch lives his life for the realm. For a king, or a lord, or the honor of this house or that house, not for gold or glory, or a woman's love, but for the realm and all the people in it.
There from HBO's Game of Thrones. And George, if I may, let's go right to our callers. Atlas, no less, is calling from Plattsburgh, New York. Atlas, you're on the air with George R. R. Martin.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I actually just started reading the series a couple of weeks ago, but it's been really fantastic, and so I'm already on Feast for Crows. And
wow, that means 10,000 pages. Good for you. What was your question?
Yeah.
Sorry,
what's that?
Just do your question, sir.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to say that I've read a lot of other fantasy series, but no other has really floored me like Game of Thrones has, because
thank you.
You were saying before, the human interaction and the characters, they seem so much more real and believable and dynamic even, especially Tyrion Lannister. Like, so many other fantasy series, of course, have dwarf characters, but no one quite like him. He really has a plight, you know? Like, you feel that he has to compensate and...
This is the dwarf son, literal dwarf, not dwarves as in Tolkien, but the dwarf as son of a big aristocrat warrior in Martin's series.
Right. And Tyrion has always been one of my favorite characters, so it's always great fun to write about him. Although in the new book, in A Dance with Dragons, he's in a very dark place. You haven't gotten to that one yet, but you'll get to it soon enough.
Atlas, what is it that you like about these that you're plowing through at such a tremendous pace?
Well, when I started the first book, I wasn't sure what to expect, really. But I got into it very quickly because, like I said, there are a few other series that really have the same feel. I mean, it's very gritty. I've heard that word used to describe the series quite often. It's other fantasy series sometimes seem very grand, but hard to really wrap your head around. But all the
well, I was inspired, of course, by Tolkien, as I think everyone working in fantasy is. But there was a second sort of source of inspiration for me when writing this series, and that was historical fiction. In addition to fantasy, I'm also a great reader and a great fan of historical fiction. And I liked that gritty quality that the best historical fiction has. A lot of fantasy has a quasi-medieval setting, but I think not so much in Tolkien, but in the hands of some of the Tolkien imitators who followed him in the decades since his death. They tend to portray sort of a Disneyland Middle Ages where they have kings and lords and the idea of chivalry, but everything is very clean and everything is a little fake and plastic. And the best historical fiction, especially historical fiction about the Middle Ages, captures that much better. And I hoped in my books to be able to weld these two traditions, the gritty realism of historical fiction with some of the cool stuff and the wonder of the best fantasy.
We've got many great questions from our listeners for you, George R.R. Martin. But for those who have not been initiated, it'd be great if you'd read a little, maybe from the new book, From a Dance with Dragons. We've got a bit here where Atlas, our caller, talked about this dwarf son, Tyrion Lannister. He's killed his father, I guess, at this point, lost
Ooh,
his nose.
Gave that away.
Oops, maybe or maybe not. Maybe I was dreaming. Okay, heads up warnings here. But you'll read it soon enough in some review. Can you set this reading up for us?
Certainly. This scene is from the beginning of A Dance with Dragons. And Tyrion has, after the events of A Storm of Swords, Tyrion has fled across the narrow sea to the city of Pentos, where he's fallen in with Illyrio Mopatis, magister of that city, who's also involved as one of the plotters playing the Game of Thrones and who has his own candidate and who basically is trying to make use of Tyrion. And this is the two of them are having a dinner together at Mopatis, at Illyrio's lavish mansion.
Mm-hmm.
More wine? Illyrio popped a pepper into his mouth. No, something better. He clapped his hands together. At the sound, a serving man entered with a covered dish. He placed it in front of Tyrion, and Illyrio leaned across the table to remove the lid. Mushrooms, the magister announced as the smell wafted up. Kissed with garlic and bathed in butter, I'm told the taste is exquisite. Have one, my friend. Have two. Tyrion had a fat black mushroom halfway to his mouth, but something in Illyrio's voice made him stop abruptly. After you, my lord. He pushed the dish toward his host. No, no. Magister Illyrio pushed the mushrooms back. For a heartbeat, it seemed as if a mischievous boy was peering out from inside the cheesemonger's bloated flesh. After you, I insist. Cook made them specially for you. Did she indeed? He remembered the cook, the flower on her hands, heavy breasts shot through with dark blue veins. That was kind of her, but no. Tyrion eased the mushroom back into the lake of butter from which it had emerged. You are too suspicious. Illyrio smiled through his forked yellow beard. Oiled every morning to make them gleam like gold, Tyrion suspected. Are you craven? I had not heard that of you. In the Seven Kingdoms, it is considered a grave breach of hospitality to poison your guest at dinner. Here as well. Illyrio Mopatis reached for his wine cup. Yet when a guest plainly wishes to end his own life, why, his host must oblige him. No? He took a gulp. Magister Adela was poisoned by a mushroom not half a year ago. The pain is not so much, I am told. Some cramping in the gut, a sudden ache behind the eyes, and it is done. Better a mushroom than a sword through your neck, is that not so? Why die with a taste of blood in your mouth when it could be butter and garlic? The dwarf studied the dish before him. The smell of garlic and butter had his mouth watering. Some part of him wanted those mushrooms, even knowing what they were. He was not brave enough to take cold steel in his own belly, but a bite of mushroom would not be so hard. That frightened him more than he could say. "You mistake me," he heard himself say. "Is it so? I wonder. If you would sooner drown in wine, say the word, and it shall be done, and quickly. Drowning cup by cup wastes time and wine both." "You mistake me," Tyrion said again, more loudly. The buttered mushrooms glistened in the lamplight, dark and inviting. "I have no wish to die, I promise you. I have..." His voice trailed off into uncertainty. "What do I have? A life to live? Work to do? Children to raise? Lands to rule? A woman to love?" "You have nothing," finished it, Magister Illyrio. "But we can change that." He plucked a mushroom from the butter and chewed it lustily. "Delicious." "The mushrooms are not poisoned." Tyrion was irritated. "No. Why should I wish you ill?" Magister Illyrio ate another. "We must show a little trust, you and I. Come, eat." He clapped his hands again. "We have work to do. My little friend must keep his strength up."
George R.R. Martin, reading from his latest in the Game of Thrones series of Song of Ice and Fire's latest, A Dance with Dragons, and with me right here in the studio. Now, that was really illuminating. The visceral pleasure with which you convey that must go to the way you write and compose here. My goodness, you're really into it yourself. It's a wonderful thing to see.
Well, yes, I like to read the books. I give readings frequently at conventions and things like that, including BossCon, the annual convention here in Boston. I enjoy attending that. And as you can tell by that, I'm also fond of food.
Yes, and you let yourself feel that fondness as you write.
Yes.
Wow, wonderful to hear you read. We've got a question on the reading front. Harry in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Harry, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. George, I'm really hooked. Fantastic books.
Oh, thank you.
I started actually listening to the books from audio, .com, and Roy DeTroyce, just incredible, the number of voices he does.
And yes, they gave him the Guinness Book of World Records for a number of different voices in an audiobook.
Yeah, I think I'd rather listen to the books than actually read them because it's just incredible. What is the process? How long does it take? Are you involved with that process in the audios?
Well, aside from selecting Roy, I worked with Roy Dotrice on Beauty and the Beast. He played Father on that show, and I was one of the writer-producers. Mm-hmm. So when we did the audiobooks, I suggested him as the reader, and Random House Audio was good enough to hire him for me, and he's magnificent, I agree. He's, of course, a classically trained British stage actor. He's done a ton of Shakespeare in addition to that. And he doesn't just read the books. He acts them out. He gives every character his own individual voice and really dramatizes. So even though he's only one person reading this 1,000-page book, you almost feel as if you have a cast of dozens of different actors there doing it.
Are you ever tempted to do it yourself? Have you been?
No. I've done a few... recordings of my short story collection, Dream Songs, has certain interstitial segments that are autobiographical. So they had me record those, and I did some studio work there. But for the stories themselves, I prefer to leave it up to professional readers and actors.
Harry in Pittsburgh, thank you so much for your call. Let me get one more. Charles in Charleston, South Carolina. Charles, you're on the air with George R.R. Martin.
Hi, Tom. I find your program to be delightful, as always.
Great.
And, Mr. Martin, may I say, it is a real honor to speak with you, sir. I had some errands to run this morning, and the first one was to pick up my new copy of A Dance with Dragons, which I am excitedly holding right now.
Glad to hear it. Glad to hear it.
My question, as someone who is also an aspiring writer, who one day certainly hopes to achieve some of the success you have, is with a story and with characters that reach the scope and sheer size of this epic fantasy you've given all of us, how do you manage the structure to know where characters have been before, whom they have interacted with, whom has spoken with this person about these events which are yet to come? How do you deal with the scope of everything you've given us from Game of Thrones and now with Dance with Dragons, the newest book, all of the events that have happened since the first novel.
Charles, that is such a great, with 1,000 named characters and counting here, that is a great question. It kind of baffles everyone. What about it, John?
I have records, of course. I have files on my computer. I have printouts. I have charts. I have genealogies. I have maps. I have all of this reference material. But actually, it's rather less than you've seen. Really, the vast majority of it is just in my head. And there are days where I say I must be mad to even attempt this. I am very thankful that I'm working in an age of computers where we do have the search function, because then when I'm writing about some character that I haven't written about for two books, I can just type in his name and the computer will find all the previous mentions of that character and I can see what I said about him just so I don't contradict myself. But it is difficult to keep all that stuff in your head sometimes. I probably should have done more thorough records back when I began in 1991. But then again, when I began in 1991, I had no idea that I'd be writing a 7-book series.
Who knew? It was supposed to be three. Now the three goal
initially,
is
yes.
7. 11 major storylines in the new book, Dance with Dragons. I'm reading here, and a bunch of minor ones as well. Lev Grossman in Time magazine called you, says your skill as a crafter of narrative exceeds that of almost any literary novelist writing today. And he goes on to say this, and I wanted to put it to you. He says the complexity of your stories, of Martin's design, ensures that we experience the struggle for Westeros, your fictional continent, from all sides at once. It's as if he's trying to show us that every fight is both triumph and tragedy, depending on where you see it from, and everybody is both hero and villain at the same time. What about that?
Yeah, I think he's accurate. Yes, that is something that I'm going for. The fight between good and evil, which has been a hallmark of so much fantasy over the years, ever since Tolkien, and Tolkien did it brilliantly, but in the hands of his imitators, mm-hmm. it's become kind of a cliche where you have the Dark Lord and he has his evil minions, and his evil minions are very evil. You know they're evil. They dress in black. They're very ugly. Mm-hmm. They have no redeeming qualities. I prefer gray characters. I prefer the philosophy that, the hero is the villain of the other side. There's – yes, things like the fight between Gandalf and the Witch King of Angmar is a great moment. But the fight between Achilles and Hector also, resonates for me and is something that I wanted to draw upon where you have two heroes fighting and I also like the idea of the story not being predictable. Too much of fantasy is too predictable. They say we write the stories that we want to read. And I was a reader long before I was a writer. And as a reader, I love stories that take me to places that I don't expect. And I hate stories where you read the first 5 pages and you know exactly what's going to happen for the rest of the book. Those stories bore me very quickly, and I don't want to bore my readers or indeed bore myself in writing. So I try to create a fairly complicated thing that's full of twists and surprises and unexpected turns, but all of them rooted hopefully in human nature and arising out of the characters and the desires and wishes and dreams of those characters.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking today of all days with medieval fantasy writer George R. R. Martin, the writer behind HBO's Game of Thrones and the huge selling author of the epic series A Song of Ice and Fire, the latest installment 6 years in the making, and no small amount of gnashing of teeth from his fans as they waited, is A Dance with Dragons. It's out today. He's with me in the studio. You may have seen some of Game of Thrones on HBO. Here's a little bit from that show. We talked about Tyrion Lannister, the dwarf son of a major player in the story, the queen of the Seven Kingdoms, has two brothers, one blonde and valiant, the other a dwarf. Here's Tyrion Lannister, the queen's dwarf brother, commiserating with Jon Snow, the son of Lord Stark.
You're Tyrion Lannister. The Queen's brother?
Greatest accomplishment. You, you're Ned Stark's bastard, aren't you?
Lord Eddard Stark is my father.
And Lady Stark is not your mother, making you the bastard. Let me give you some advice, bastard. Never forget what you are. The rest of the world will not. Wear it like armor, and it can never be used to hurt you.
What the hell do you know about being a bastard?
All dwarves are bastards in their father's eyes.
From HBO's Game of Thrones, you had a hand in Game of Thrones. How big a hand?
Well, I wrote one of the scripts for this season. There were 10 episodes. I wrote one. And I was a co-executive producer. So I functioned largely as a consultant. The showrunners are David Benioff and D.B. Weiss. They're the executive producers who, wrote most of the scripts. I think they wrote 7 out of the 10 and had a hand in supervising everything. But I was consulted on all the casting and all that. So I felt I was as involved as I could be. I mean, my first priority has to be to continue the books. And although there's part of me that would love to be there every day and write more of the scripts and, you know, work with Dan and Dave and see it develop, that's a full-time job. And I have another full-time job, which is finishing these books. I mean, with
and if you don't recall books, that, your listeners will tell you.
Yes, indeed. Yes.
Benioff once described this. He later recanted a little bit or changed, but he described this as the Sopranos in Middle Earth.
Yeah, well, that's a Hollywood high concept thing when he was trying to sell it here. They love to hear things like that out in Hollywood.
and so off it's gone. Julie in Burlington, Vermont's calling. Julie, you're on with George R. R. Martin.
Hi, Tom. Enjoy the show.
Thank you.
George, I just wanted to say that I've just been devouring the series. I only discovered it probably a few weeks ago, a few months ago, when the HBO series came on.
Glad to hear you're enjoying it.
Oh, absolutely. Halfway through Feast of Crows, so I'm on my way right now to go pick up the next one. But I heard that you had written, perhaps they were short stories or some side stories about hedge knights that took place in an earlier time frame. Could you talk a little bit about that, and do I need to read those first?
Certainly. Well, you don't need to read those first, but you might enjoy reading those. Those are the Duncan Egg stories, as I call them. There's three of them. They're novellas, which are about 30,000 words, about a third the size of a normal novel, and much smaller compared to my novels. They take place in Westeros, but about 100 years earlier than the events of A Song of Ice and Fire. So it's in a period where the Targaryen dynasty is still going strong and ruling. And they chronicle the exploits of a hedge knight named Sir Duncan the Tall and his squire Egg as they travel about the Seven Kingdoms. You'd have to find those. Those were published in anthologies. The first one was published in an anthology called Legends, edited by Robert Silverberg. And the second one, that's called The Hedge Knight. The second one, The Sworn Sword, was published in Legends 2, also edited by Robert Silverberg. And the third one, The Mystery Knight, was published in an anthology that I edited myself with Gardner Dozois called Warriors, which you should be able to find at any good bookstore.
Julie, thanks for your call. And one more right here, Leah calling from Medford, Massachusetts. Leah, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Mr. Martin.
Hi there.
I'm calling to ask how you are able to kill off characters if the plot merits it. Since these people live in your head in such a real way and have been with you for such a long time. How are you able to just off them whenever you need to?
Well, it is hard, actually.
You brutal man.
I mean, in some sense, these are the children of my mind, and they're characters whose skins I have lived inside. Viewpoint characters in particular, where you're writing from inside their head and you're seeing the world as they see it. And while writing those chapters, you actually sort of become those characters. And then to kill them off is difficult. There's A chapter in the third book, which people who have read the books will know which I'm referring to, that where a number of characters die, and it was the hardest thing I ever wrote. When I wrote that third book, A Storm of Swords, I skipped over that particular chapter, even though it occurs about two-thirds of the way through the book, and I wrote the rest of the book, and then only when everything else was done could I force myself to go back and write that chapter, since it was so emotionally wrenching. So why do I do it? Well, I think it's necessary. I mean, I spoke earlier about how predictable stories bore me, and we've all, you know, seen the stories where the hero, you know, he seems to get in trouble. He's all alone. He's surrounded by 20 foes, but he's the hero. You know he's going to get out of it. You're not really engaged. Mm-hmm. I want you to be engaged. I want you to feel what the viewpoint character is feeling. If the viewpoint character is in trouble, I want you to be afraid. I want you not to know whether he's going to get out of it. And I think the only way to do that is establish very early in the books that you're playing for real, that anyone can die, and that if the character is in a life or death situation, that he might not survive it, that these are not superheroes, these are not Indiana Jones, these are fallible human beings who are vulnerable to death and betrayal and all that. To my mind, that makes the stories much more suspenseful and gripping and emotionally involving.
Lots of questions online, and Leah, thanks for your call. Lots of questions about the grist for this long, long, long story. Stories, kind of a spectrum here. Brandt says, I'm interested if changes in his, your, own life, career, and craft have made characters and the plot grow or change over the course of the books. He's looking to autobiography as a potential source of what comes in here. But Ellen writes from a much grander scale, I'm interested, she writes, in what motivates him as the writer and those who read it. Is it family dynamics? Is it issues of power and greed? Is it an attempt to lay out a comprehensive emotoscape of modern awareness?
Well, yeah, I think all of those play a role. Certain, you know, family dynamics, autobiography. Obviously, I'm not a prince or a lord from a medieval kingdom. I'm not a dwarf. I'm not a 9-year-old girl. I'm none of these things. But I think the writer's gift is empathy and imagination and trying to put yourself in the position of this. And really, not to get too existential here, but the only person any human being ever really knows is himself or herself. So you can draw on other people you know. You can draw on characters from history and biographies you've read about other people. But ultimately, to really make the character come alive, I think you have to reach into yourself and look at your own life and take elements of it, particularly the emotional elements of it, to try to give a certain emotional grounding and emotional reality to your characters, as different as they may seem to be on the surface.
Let me ask you then, if I may, because you began talking about how as a young man, even a boy, stories of medieval chivalry were an inspiration to you. It sounded to me in your description as though the idealism in those ideals may be inspiring to you even today. Chivalry, all that, very high. At the same time, here you've got one of your characters, you know, saying very clearly in here, and this is a kind of theme. There's a lot of cruelty. There's a lot of rough stuff. Theon says, there are no heroes, only whores. This hardly sounds like the motto of an age of chivalry.
Theon is not the most admirable character in the books, to be fair here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, actually, you can say that the whole question of heroism has been one that's engrossed me since the very beginnings of my career, even before I was a professional. I mean, I mentioned I started out reading comic books, mm-hmm. and the first stories I wrote were about comic books. And in some ways, the comic book superhero, Superman and his ilk, Spider-Man, Iron Man.
Archetypal.
These are the descendants of the medieval knights. Mm-hmm. They're people whose goal is to defend the innocent and protect the weak and you know, truth, justice, the American way. Sometimes at great personal cost to themselves. So yeah, there's something in that obviously resonates with me, and I like to play with that concept and examine it and turn it this way and that, and I guess in some cases test it to destruction and to see how it fares.
Sue in Melrose, Massachusetts. Sue, you're on with George R.R. Martin.
Hi, Tom. Love your show.
Thank you.
Hi, George.
Hi there.
I just wanted to thank you for a wonderful series of books. I'm waiting for my pre-order to be dropped on my front porch as we speak.
Good.
I wanted to thank you for writing such wonderfully strong and terrific female characters.
No, you're welcome.
There really aren't that many in science fiction and fantasy and any of that kind of stuff. And I was really struck by they're terrific, and they're not all nice and namby-pamby, and they're gritty, and some of them don't do very nice things. And I think it's really cool, and I think it's a really good read for young women that they don't have to just read, you know, sword and sorcerer novels where the woman is just a damsel in distress and gets rescued all the time.
Well, I'm very pleased to hear you say that, because that's certainly one of the things I've attempted to do. And you know, my attitude on this is to provide a range of different characters. I'd like to think that my books have women of all sorts. They have warrior women and women who are perhaps more vulnerable. They have strong women and weak women. They have good women and bad women. And sometimes the same woman behaving differently in different circumstances, which is something that I also think happens.
Sue, thanks very, very much for that. Let me get another right here, if I may. Mike in Farmington, Connecticut. Mike, you're on. Thanks for calling.
Oh, hi, Tom. George, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
George, I just wanted to comment that I really appreciate the overall arc of the story, as you named it, A Song of Ice and Fire. I think that that's probably where you're going with the story. Don't confirm that if you don't want to, but it seems like the main story is more of a conflict between ice and fire and what's happening north of the wall versus what Dany's awakening, and rather than the contest for the throne of Westeros.
Well, I think I'll be suitably enigmatic about that and let you and other readers make that decision for yourself.
Mike, I appreciate your call, but this issue of where you're going, we know it has tortured you a bit. You talked with the New Yorker and, you know, about how you've struggled with this. You know, you said to them that, you know, what if I mess it up? you didn't like the ending of Lost, the long-running TV show, so much, I guess, I take from their reporting, and the ambiguity of it, the kind of failure to wrap it all up. I mean, it must be daunting when you're churning out these 1,000-page monsters, and then you'll have 7 of them in a row lined up to bring it to an end. Are you worried about torchlight parades outside the manse in Santa Fe?
Well, yes, to an extent. I mean, obviously, I've gotten some wonderful reviews and notices on this series, and you know, I would hate to kind of fumble the ball in the last yard before scoring a touchdown here. I want to provide an ending that's very powerful and that's satisfying and appropriate. And of course, I have such an ending in mind, but there's still 2 more books to write, so there's a lot of work to do, and there may be stumbles and difficulties along the way. But it's a daunting task because of the size of it. You know, on one hand, you don't want the ending to be too predictable, but on the other hand, it has to pay off the things that you've said in earlier. That's the challenge of writing a series like this.
You are so scrutinized in this age where people through, you know, the electronic media, digital media, feel they have so much access. They're watching. They don't want you to shuffle off this earthly coil early like Robert Jordan did. His listeners couldn't have him write the last part. The vitriol saying, hurry up and write, George, got so heavy, a year or two ago, that you posted a blog entry titled "To My Detractors," to speaking to the rising tide of venom about the lateness of A Dance with Dragons. You said some of you are angry that I watch football during the fall. Others, you wrote, are object to visiting places like Spain and Portugal or Finland. And you said at the end, as some of you like to point out in your emails, I am 60 years old and fat, and you don't want me to pull a Robert Jordan on you and deny you your book. How did that retort go with your fans?
Well, I do have these detractors, but I think I need to stress that they're a small minority. I have, you've read some of the statistics. I have millions of readers, and the vast majority of emails I get and mails I get are very supportive and are great. So there are thousands and thousands of fans who write me terrific letters. But then I do get these letters that are less terrific, that are very nasty. And the thing about pulling a Jordan particularly irked me, and that was probably one of the things that triggered that post. You know, Robert Jordan, whose real name was James Rigney, was a great fantasy writer from who lived down south in Charleston, South Carolina, and was working on his Wheel of Time series, his magnum opus, and who died of a rare blood disease. And to trivialize his death by calling it pulling a Jordan, as if he had died just to to vex these fans and cheat them of their last book, was so callous and insensitive.
George R. R. Martin, for today we celebrate. On the other hand, you've pulled another opus out of your hat, A Dance with Dragons. Great day for your fans, and we've heard that in their voices here this hour. It's been great having you with us. Good luck with the last two big ones, and thank you so much for coming in.
Oh, my welcome. Thank you for having me. It's been terrific.
George R. R. Martin. Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.